Over the past several years, as I've come to understand and enjoy my sexuality more and more, at the same time, kind of parallel to that, I've come to understand just the generosity of God. What an incredible God that He would give us sexuality.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine, continuing their series on biblical sexual ethics.
You and I have had quite a few discussions in the area of sexuality. And last week, when we were talking, Jack, there was something that you said or a way that you responded to me that was confusing to me. And I thought I'd bring it up again today for people who were listening last week. They may not remember because it went by very quickly. And you may not even remember the incident. But I just thought I'd throw it in here for a minute.
Okay.
See where I could go with it. I was talking about kind of generically my failure and saying that I remember I making the comment something like, you know, I failed 20 times with my husband last week or yesterday, and I just haven't seen him yet today, so I haven't had any failures yet. And I think I said something like, isn't that true also in your life? And I really didn't get much of a response from you. And I, knowing you, I know that you admit to the sinfulness in your life. But I was a little bit taken aback by not having a response from you. So I just thought I'd go back to that and see.
Okay, yeah. I've become aware in recent times as I teach and as I talk about what the New Testament is teaching about our sinfulness and salvation and sanctification and so on. I've become aware of how important it is that I not exaggerate my own failures or not only not exaggerate, but not highlight them in a way that would tend to diminish the work of sanctification that the Spirit does in a person's life. It's an incredibly difficult, these are difficult waters to navigate because on the one hand, never in a million years would I want to leave the impression that now that Jesus has come into my life, I don't struggle any longer or I'm not weak any longer or I'm not a bad person or I'm not evil any longer. The Bible teaches me otherwise and my experience teaches me otherwise. I think I know myself well enough to know that I don't even know myself. How deeply the evil goes. I see areas of my life when I do things that I think are so well intentioned and such great motives and out of desires that are so pure, and it devastates my wife, and it destroys my children. It becomes apparent that there's something deeply, deeply wrong with who I am as a person.
When you are even blind to your own sinfulness,
exactly,
such that it hurt your wife deeply. You don't even know it.
Right. And I've learned over the course of time that I cannot excuse it by saying, well, I didn't mean to, or that's not what I meant, or I didn't intend that. But that's how insidious lawlessness, sinfulness, disobedience is. The evil that's seething in every one of our hearts is so sabotages our life that it doesn't bother to work through our motives. It just is there as a structure of my personality. As a part of the person that I am capable of being hostile to God and everything, every principle that He stands for, and I act against that, and I do it spontaneously, and I do it naturally, and I do it easily, I do it automatically, and it's terrible. That's what it means for us to be sinful, and we have to come to terms with that. I have to come to terms with that, and I think I have begun in my life to understand that about myself. So on the one hand, I wouldn't in any way want to minimize or diminish that. I don't pretend to be a better person than I am. At least I normally don't. I'm so evil that sometimes I do, but but I know better than that. I know that I am fundamentally and profoundly evil. On the other hand, I think it would be a huge mistake to leave the impression that the lifestyle of a person who has taken seriously discipleship with Jesus is no different from the lifestyle of a person who has shined Jesus on and doesn't want to have anything to do with him. They're not the same. It makes a dramatic difference in our life when we decide to hear Jesus out and listen to his words and begin to live our lives in the light of what he says is true. Because it puts a check on our life. We don't go where we would go if Jesus weren't saying, love your neighbor and submit to one another and humble yourselves and love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. If I weren't listening to those and taking those seriously, there's all kinds of places I might go in my life and would go and could go in my life that I don't let myself go because I don't want to do that. Because I've heard the voice of Jesus and I want to follow him. It really does have a dramatic effect on my life. Now, the mistake a lot of Christians make is they say, well, because your lifestyle is different, and I think you could even argue a better lifestyle, aren't you therefore a better person? And the answer to that is no, not really. Because a better person, a good person, wouldn't even ultimately be tempted by those things that I'm tempted by. Wouldn't even find it thinkable to go into areas of, if we're talking about sexuality, for example, would not find perverse, licentious sexuality attractive. But I can't make that claim. I know why that has a hook in people. I know why that's appealing to people, because it's appealing to me. It's inherently and intrinsically a temptation. And the only reason I don't go in there in my life is because I have learned by the grace of God that being a person of integrity and being a righteous person, I have this growing desire that I find within me to have that kind of integrity and demonstrate that kind of integrity, and that's more important to me than going where I'd want to go otherwise.
And it's that desire that puts a check on your life.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, when I talk about having failed 20 times yesterday with my husband, What that means to me, and I think it's why you hesitated, as I'm understanding now, it doesn't mean that I just put no check on my life, that I just full force went into sin and said, I just don't even care. But really what that looks like in my life, my failing 20 times or however many times I fail during a day, looks like sometimes I don't even know it until, right, like you with Jody, I get feedback. And I get feedback from my husband. I remember just yesterday, he was saying something to me, and I had kind of a quick comeback, and then he wanted to say it to me again, and I did again. And it wasn't because I was trying to be hurtful toward him, but I really was. It was very hurtful toward him. I can't remember the exact incident right now, or I'd share it in detail, but I can't remember it. I stumbled into it. I didn't intend to. But nonetheless, it was wrong. It was hurtful. It was thoughtless. And that's the kind, and sometimes I have to say that I definitely look at the options and think, you know, I don't care right this second, or I just want to be lazy, or maybe he won't notice, or, mm-hmm. you know, I do things like that are hurtful in the course of a day. But the general direction of my life is I don't even want to stumble into sin, and I do. I don't want to, when I step back, have a knee-jerk, sinful reaction. I don't want to be hurtful to my husband. I want to be a person that's loving and kind, and to pay the cost for that. I want that very deeply. And in the midst of life, as it goes on, I fail a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, part of my problem is I don't know how to count something like selfishness. I mean, it's not that I'm selfish 20 times a day. I'm selfish perpetually throughout the day.
Because, but we see it maybe 20 times.
Yeah, because so much of our selfishness is not—it's not conscious. It's my unconsciousness of the other people around me. It's the fact that I am so absorbed in my own day and my own business and my own concerns and so on, that I'm disregarding these other interests and these other concerns of people around me, that I really, if I were a good person, I'd be sensitive to those and I'd be responsive to those.
If you were a good person, that is morally perfect.
If I'm morally perfect, yeah. And ideally, we begin to get a vision of what it would mean to be that kind of person, and we decide that's what the kingdom of God is all about. In the kingdom of God, I will be the kind of person who is so much a person for others that I am constantly and perpetually and continually and naturally and automatically loving them in the way that would be right and good and appropriate. Well, I'm not there. I'm not there by any stretch of the imagination. And I know, as the Bible, as the biblical message presents itself, I'm not going to be there in this lifetime. And I'm kidding myself if I think I will. But what I can do is I can be open to seeing my selfishness and calling it that when it kind of becomes jarringly apparent to me. And that's, there's a spiritual difference between being a fundamentally selfish person who confronts his selfishness, calls it what it is, and asks wife and children and neighbors and friends for forgiveness, versus the person who is also perpetually selfish and refuses to ever see it, refuses to ever acknowledge it. And they go through hurting one person after the next, after the next, after the next, and they just keep going basically unrepentant. Those are not spiritually equivalent. They are both fundamentally and profoundly evil, but one is in a very, very different place spiritually, the one who's open to acknowledging their selfishness. And so I wouldn't ever want to leave the impression that as a disciple of Jesus, I can live through my day unrepentantly selfish, and that's okay. I'm being a good disciple of Jesus. That's not okay. I'm not being a good disciple of Jesus if I can do that. There has to be a kind of response to my evil where I mourn it. I grieve. I am horrified by it. I repudiate it. I hate it.
It makes me sick. I wish it would stop.
Right.
And it even makes me, for me, Jack, it makes me kind of yearn for heaven. Like, let me just get rid of this sinfulness of mine. Let me just get over it. I remember, actually, years ago, somebody said to me, if you could have anything in the world, what would you want? And I surprised myself because I started thinking, what would I want? And what I said at that point, it was really a turning point for me. I said, I would like to not be a sinner. And it surprised me with joy that on one hand, it's so sad that I'm such a sinner that that's the only thing that I'd really want most. On the other hand, to me, it was a sign of spiritual development where I was starting to really know that that's not what I wanted. What I want in my life is a quality of life that's springing up from the Spirit, and that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it means to be a child of God. And the more we mature in that, the stronger the urge for, the stronger the longing for that goodness, I think, becomes.
Yeah. Let me bring us back to a small point that you brought up, and I think it's a good one. It's one that I've stumbled on, and I see a lot of people stumbling on. You said that sin is sin even if we don't intend it.
Mm-hmm.
Sin is sin even if I didn't mean to do it. And I know in my own life, when I'm going along and I'm really trying my best, and I, without poise, knock the person in front of me down by my behavior or my words or something, and I want to excuse it because I didn't mean to. I really didn't intend to hurt you, and I want to kind of stand on that. And I think that that's really overlooking the reality that there is sin in me that comes out all the time. It isn't, am I going to sin? It's, where am I sinning?
Mm-hmm.
Where is it happening now? And so that kind of defense keeps me from really looking at the reality of the sin in my life. And I think that part, in part, comes from, I don't expect grace. I don't understand grace big enough. I don't understand forgiveness. And I think that in part comes from the way that we as people relate to each other. When somebody hurts us, we really want to hold it against them. When I've hurt other people, they've really wanted to hold it against me. I see that I must have learned that as a child in part because I see myself teaching that to my children with hating it. But for example, Jack, my kids could do something really awful. I'm thinking about something that one of my kids did. It wasn't that awful. It was just, they just left a mess out in the backyard, and then in the dining room, and then in the kitchen, and then down in their bedroom, and then up the stairs, and then, you know, as parents, you know, we can all say, oh, man, that happens all the time, and I was just so frustrated with it. And so I think, and I got so mad at my child, and it wasn't with a sense of forgiveness or, boy, you blew it, but I still love you. I had to come back to explaining that to them. But we, I think in all sorts of encounters like that, both with our parents and all sorts of people, we don't have that sense in the here and now of really being forgiven, really having grace, really having mercy from people when we really get in their way and when we really blow it. And so I think we translate that into our lives and we want to protect ourselves from what might hurt. And so I say, oh, I didn't intend it, so don't be mad at me, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, don't be mad because I didn't mean to.
Yeah.
And because we do expect people to be mad at us, not for people to still love us and have grace toward us when we mess up.
Mm-hmm. And we transfer that over to God. We expect Him to be unforgiving with respect to my sin as well. I think that is true. I think without really fully understanding how deep and profound the mercy of God is and the forgiveness of God is, I don't see how we can be free to look at ourselves. We have to consider the implications of the cross, Jesus dying on the cross, and what that means and what that's all about before we really can say, all right, I can look at myself with brutal honesty and find whatever there really is to find there and call it what it really is, and I can be okay because it's forgiven.
And
that's important to come to terms with.
It's entirely important. It's so bedrock to our ability to function in this world.
Yeah.
It really is. As a counselor, I run into that just tons and tons. And what I think has to happen first with people who really are unconvinced of forgiveness and from people and then therefore forgiveness from God or God's mercy is, in many times, I have to kind of be the example of that to other people. They'll tell me the most heinous things in their lives. And sometimes almost testing to see what my response will be. And it could be for them one of the first experiences in their life where they're both being told the truth, confronted with the reality of the sin in their life, and coupled with me not saying I'm different, not judging them, not telling them that they're other than me, not being self-righteous in regard to the things that they're telling me, giving them mercy, in other words, recognizing that out of my own need, I can give them, I have lots of mercy for people because I can see how much I blow it. But anyway, that's often a way for them to then transfer that onto, oh, if the person here can be forgiving me, can be merciful toward me, then how much more God can be.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, it's just like a light turned on in a very, very dark room. And it's a really incredibly good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack, that's what's so hard as parents is I really want to communicate to them a great deal of mercy. And yet I struggle with that on a day-to-day basis. It's so much easier for me to be a counselor in a room with people in a defined period of time than it is for me to be outside in life and be hit with the difficulty of life and the ongoingness of life all the time and of children and being able to still demonstrate mercy and forgiveness and love toward them in the midst of their behavior that really is a problem, causes problems in my life.
Yeah. And that when it comes to the issue, that this comes back to the issue that we started with, you know, how evil are we really? And one of the things that we need to understand, I think, is that evil really has to do with the potential for what I am capable of how I'm capable of behaving, more than it is what I've actually done and my actual behavior. I would like to say,
in some cases, Hitler made it all happen.
Yeah, right, exactly. But that's my point, is because I haven't done what Hitler's done, am I somehow morally better than Hitler? And, you know, to some people, it may just seem outrageous to answer that, no, I'm no better than Hitler, because I, even though I haven't done what he's done. But I really think that if we understand the nature of evil, then we will understand that, no, I'm not any better than Hitler. Why did Hitler do what he did? Because he's more evil? No. but because he had a different life history, he had different experiences, he made different choices, he had different temptations, he had different forces at work on him, would I have done any better had I had the same forces at work on me, the same history, the same temptations, and so on? And I think I can honestly say, no, I probably wouldn't have done any better than he did.
Oh, I would say it's a resounding no. I read a book by Alice Miller years ago. It's called For Your Own Good. And she has a case history of the Germans and Hitler during his era. And she was making the same argument that you are, that given all these circumstances, it makes sense that these people would have been the way they were. And I asked myself the question at the time, could that be me? And that's when my most profound understanding of my sin came to light for me, was in reading that book and saying, if I'd been there, I'd have done it. And that's frightening to me. The fact that I don't have the history, the circumstances, the people around me, that the culture around me that he did, is just a gift from God.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how I look at my life. I mean, that sometimes it's very difficult for me to identify with the actual behavior of people that I'm talking to. They have made choices that I have not made. They are living lifestyles that I'm not living. But what I have to try to communicate to them and what they have to try to understand is that doesn't make me better than them. It just means I have a different history and I've had different forces at work in my life. But hopefully it's the case, I think it's the case, that I am well aware that I could be exactly where they're at. And it's not for any virtue in my character that I am not living that lifestyle and have had that history and making those choices. It's just because life has gone differently for me. So that comes back to what we started with. I would love to be able to, and sometimes it's tempting to kind of make up things about yourself and say, yes, I've sinned in all the ways that you've sinned. Well, the reality is maybe I haven't. Maybe I haven't made all those choices in my life sexually that some people have, for example. But do I think I'm better because of that? Not at all. I really understand. I don't care how kinky and perverse a sexual lifestyle somebody has. I think I really fully understand that I could be there. It'd be entirely possible for me to be living the lifestyle they're living. It's by the grace of God that I'm not.
Okay.
But not by the virtue of my character. That's not what I mean.
What comes to mind here real quickly, and I don't want to discuss it, but people say this to me so often, it comes up so much. Then how come God didn't give Hitler the same grace that he gave you? Why did he do it so differently to you than he did to Hitler? And that's such a huge question.
Maybe a future program.
Maybe a future program. I see this big smile on your face of, wow, that's a big one. But, you know, it is something that comes across people's minds all the time, and especially when I talk to people who have been so hurtfully treated in their lives, and they lots of times just cannot understand why God would allow, is the way they put it.
Well, the passage that always comes to mind to me is in the last chapter of John. Jesus is by the Sea of Galilee walking with John and Peter. He's talking to Peter. And it appears that Peter and he are walking along the shore, and John is kind of following a distance behind. And Jesus is telling Peter, "You know what's going to happen to you? Is you're going to be persecuted. You're going to be killed, like I was killed." And Peter, I think, getting a little bit nervous about this prediction, turns and points to John and says, "What about him?" And I've always found Jesus' response very helpful to me. He says, "Well, that's another story, isn't it?" That's a loose translation, but
this
is another story, isn't it? Basically, you worry about you, Peter. I'll worry about God. Will worry about John. God's going to do with John what God's going to do with John, and God's going to do with Peter what God's going to do with Peter, and what God does with John is really basically none of your business, Peter. And you know, on the one hand, it's kind of rude and a shocking response, but it's the more I think about it, it really helps me get my life in perspective. It gets my life in perspective. If God has blessed me with a lot of blessings, that's God's prerogative. I mean, I don't need to feel guilty. I don't need to feel shame for being given some wonderful gifts by God on the one hand. In the mystery of what God has determined to do, that's what he's determined to do. And if I have lived a life of nothing but suffering and misery, where does my comfort lie? My comfort has to lie in the fact that for whatever reasons, locked up again in the mystery of God's will, he's told a different story through my life than the other people around me. And the way I have to come to terms with it is, has he deprived me or robbed me of anything of any eternal worth? And the answer to that is, no, not if he's given you an inheritance in the kingdom of God. Your life down here has been rough, but it's been the route that God has taken you on to get you to the kingdom of God one day. But if you get there, you've got everything. That's really all there is to human existence. And that's all that God has ever promised any of us. If we can really come to terms with what he's saying there, I think there's a tremendous amount of comfort in that.
Well, Jack, today we're supposed to be talking about sexuality. And maybe we've gotten ourselves a little bit off track. So I think, though, this is a good foundation to start talking about sexuality once again. Recognizing our own failure and having kind of a context to understand that a little bit better is an important area to understand when we look at sexuality.
Well, before we get back to the actual topic at hand, maybe...
You're going to lead me away one more time?
Well, it relates to sexuality directly, but this is the appropriate context for it. It wasn't that long ago I was reading in the newspapers about, I think it's Presbyterian Church, some branch of the Presbyterian Church, was debating and voting on whether or not they were going to require of their ministers that they abstain from sex outside of marriage. I believe that was the issue. And it was this huge controversy, evidently, in the denomination. On the one hand, my reaction is, controversy? what exactly
Why
is the controversy?
Why should it be a controversy?
But it reminds me, the problem that we have when it comes to our sexuality, it's true of all of our life, but you really see it dramatically in the area of our sexuality, is if we really don't understand the profundity of God's grace and God's mercy and God's forgiveness in the way that we were just describing, we're not open and we don't have the freedom to face into the truth of my moral depravity and my sinfulness. One of the ways that manifests itself is that there's this constant, continual pressure on us to change our standards, to redefine what sexual sin is in the area of sexuality. So it's so easy for us to think in terms of, well, everybody does it. I mean, everybody has a problem in this area. Everybody is kind of, you know, everybody commits adultery. Everybody fornicates. Everybody sleeps around. So if everybody is doing it, how can we get away with calling it wrong? I mean, isn't that kind of an overreaction to call it sin? It's just part of the kind of normal struggle of being a human being. So let's not call it sin. Let's have a little heart here. Let's be compassionate. Let's be merciful. Let's change the way we talk about this thing. I think it's absolutely vital. And you know, you've commented on a number of occasions how old-fashioned we sound or how... How conservative we sound. Well, I suppose in a sense it is conservative in the sense that I'm wanting to look at the biblical standards as they really are, not try to make them more workable for us. I want them to be as truly unworkable as they really are, because the standards, the biblical standards on how we should conduct ourselves sexually, as much as anything else in the Bible, confront us with how far short we fall of being good people sexually. We are not good people. We are broken, we are perverse, we are immoral, we are given over to sensuality that we'll talk about later. We don't even begin to know what it would mean to be a truly good person in the area of our sexuality. Well, our standards should reveal that to us. Our standards shouldn't be workable. They should be the kinds of standards that get in my face about how terribly immoral I am. But why is it, what gives us the freedom? How is it that we can allow those standards to be as exacting and as severe and as unreachable as they really are? Only if I understand the forgiveness of God and the grace of God and the mercy of God. Only if I understand that my acceptance in God's eyes is not based on how good a person I am sexually. I could admit from the outset, I'm broken. I'm not there. I can't be that kind of person.
Yeah, when I have a view of Christianity or my faith that I have to be good to be acceptable to God, I'm not even going to be looking for God's grace. I'm going to be looking for how good I can be, how well I can just meet the standard. And that's really the opposite of what you're talking about here.
Right.
It comes from understanding grace that we can then let ourselves be exposed to the reality of the sinfulness in whatever area, but specifically in the area of sexuality that we're trying to talk about today. Okay, Jack, we wanted to talk about sensuality today. And what about if we come at looking at sensuality from the opposite side? Let's look at what sexual intimacy is all about, what the purpose is. Now, we've talked about this in the past, but just for people who haven't heard or just for some review, let's talk about what that is. What is the purpose of sexual intimacy?
Yeah, as you say, we've talked about this at length, but just briefly, as I would understand it, the only way to put the evidence together from both life experience and the Bible is that sexual intimacy is a kind of language that God has built into the human psyche. It's a way for two people committed to one another, a husband to his wife and a wife to her husband. It's a way for them to both celebrate and ratify and proclaim in a nonverbal language their commitment to one another. And that alone really is the purpose. I shouldn't say that alone. There are secondary aspects of sexuality. It does involve pleasure. It does make babies. It is for procreation. Those are obviously a part of sexuality, but its primary purpose, the thing that gives it its reason for existence in the relationship, is this language that we can use to proclaim our commitment to one another.
And, Jack, that sounds a little dry, so I'm going to try and spice it up a little bit.
Sorry about that.
The reality is it's a little spicier than that. Come on. When you say ratify our commitment, it kind of sounds dry and uninteresting and like, oh, gee, to me it kind of sounds like a math problem.
Well, it's a fun way to ratify our commitment.
Gee. You didn't make it sound very fun. You know, I'm listening back to some of our tapes sometimes, and I think, boy, I've thought this before, so I thought maybe if I had the opportunity, I'd talk about it a little bit more. So, Jack, the commitment we made on one hand is a very serious one.
Mm-hmm.
To my husband, it's a very serious one. I've said that I'll commit my life to you, to your best interest, and to my own, and together we'll work together to have a relationship that really puts us in a classroom of life, teaches us about God, teaches us about ourselves. Teaches us the very essentials of what life is about, and I think marriage does that more than any other thing in the world, except for perhaps having kids. Is to me, that's a pretty big classroom too.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that when I'm committing myself to my husband, or when I'm communicating that through sex, it's a very, very beautiful and very, very unique way to say, "I love you.
Right.
You are. I cherish you.
You are the most important person in my life.
You are so important to me, so important that I will be as vulnerable to you with my body that I could possibly be. I will open up to you. I will be with you in a place that I'm unwilling to be with anyone else. And that's wrong for me to be with anyone else. But in an incredibly intimate and sharing and giving and caring atmosphere that also includes very often a great deal of pleasure, a great deal of delight, a great deal of, during the process of being sexual and afterwards, sense of well-being and sense of being cared for and caring for."
That sounds like a lot more fun than ratifying your commitment, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I meant, exactly. That one of our greatest needs psychologically, one of the things that we long for more than anything else, as just human beings in this world, human creatures in this world, is that kind of sense of specialness, that kind of sense of being treasured. And exactly, I think that's the real pleasure of sexuality, is that someone is saying to me, and that's my primary point, they are saying to me with their body, "You are the most important person in the world. I treasure you." And the thing that we have to come to terms with is, we are saying that even when we don't mean it. That is, we are saying that in the act of sex, even if the rest of my life, I'm not going to follow through on that. I just saw recently a movie, I think it's The Man in the Iron Mask, and And there's a scene in there where the king, who is routinely sleeping with whoever he wants to, has slept with this young woman, and she's making some comment about, you know, what a special intimate moment it was to him. And he says, "I'm hungry." She says, "Can I get you something to eat?" And he says, "Oh, I always eat alone," and walks out of the room. And it just captured in a moment for me the truth of what I'm saying here, is that, you know, whether he likes it or not, he made some promises to that woman in that bed. You know, he was making her feel treasured. He was making her feel special. He was making her feel important to him in the very act of sexual intimacy. He just did. Whether he meant it or not doesn't make any difference. That's what he said to her. But obviously he doesn't have to mean it, because he can share his bed with her, but he's not interested in sharing his food with her or sharing his time with her at a meal.
Even though he did say it through being sexual with her, he's telling himself, "I didn't say anything."
Yeah, he lied to her. And that's what's so fundamentally wrong with sex outside of marriage, is that it's only in the context of marriage where sex is not a lie. And it can even be within the context of marriage.
Certainly.
But only in the context of marriage where I really am committed to my wife or husband, and I really do plan to give them my all, my time, my energy, my attention, my respect, and everything. Only then am I giving them what I'm actually promising them with my body in sexual intimacy. So my point is, the most important pleasure in sexual intimacy is not the physical pleasure. It's not orgasm. It's not arousal. It's none of that stuff. As much a part of sexuality as it is, that's not the most important pleasure. The most important pleasure is, someone has told me, they may be lying to me, or they may be telling me the truth, but they have told me, "You're the most important person in my life right now." And that feels good. That's an incredibly powerful feeling, and very important pleasure. Philosophers, in talking about sexuality, have occasionally entertained the notion, you know, what if you could invent an orgasm machine, so that all, a pleasure machine, where you plugged yourself into this machine and you could have an orgasm at will? Would it replace human sexuality? And almost universally, they've acknowledged that no, it wouldn't. Well, why? An orgasm is an orgasm. So what is it about an actual encounter, an actual physical encounter between a man and a woman, that is so much more valuable to a person than just the physical pleasure of physical orgasm? Well, I think it's the psychological pleasure of having someone say to me, "You're the most important person in the world. I treasure you. I need you. I want you. I desire you. You are valuable to me." And I think that's the most important driving force in our sexuality.
What just occurs to me again is, I'm trying to take this sexuality out of the realm of something dry and cold, and I think we're getting closer, getting away from ratifying your commitment as something that sounds really dry to me. But I just wanted to make the comment, isn't it an incredible thing that God gave us? Yeah. Isn't it it seems like it was so unnecessary. It wasn't vital to our existence like food is, like water is. We could have had very intimate and very good and very warm relationships apart from sexuality, and yet God gave that to us. Just, it seems to me like He gave us flowers. Mm-hmm. Just as something beautiful, something wonderful, something, it seems like it must match a character of His that I don't hear about it in Knowledge of the Holy, or, I don't know, books that talk about the character of God, but His generosity. It just seems so generous that He would give us sexuality.
Yeah, that's true. It is at the same time one of the most beautiful things in human existence and one of the oddest things in human existence. Precisely because it does seem so frivolous and unnecessary, I think. But it is. It's a very beautiful human experience to have someone say to me in such a beautiful and poignant and dramatic and pleasurable way, You are special. You're valuable.
It's an amazing thing. You know, I've often thought about this, that it is kind of odd that God would give us something so wonderful. Just kind of a, gave us a human hunger and then gave us a way to satisfy it in such an incredible way. I love it. I think we're talking about the mercy of God earlier in this program. And it seems to me that really is a merciful God that would give us something like this. Such a good God, such a loving God, such a God that has our interest in his mind, that we really are important to him. That's just, I don't know, I just think it's so way cool.
Yeah.
I also think there are people who won't have a clue what we're talking about really here today, that sexuality has become something so profoundly difficult. It's such a struggle, struggling to stay away from what they know is wrong. For other people, such a struggle because it has been the face of abuse to them, of hurtfulness, of intrusive invasion that has just decimated their life. And for that, I'm very sorry. I'm very sorry to be talking about something that not everybody gets to experience, not everybody knows about. And I wanted to acknowledge that right now, that for some people, they're going to have a different experience of sexuality, and it never will be full, it never will be satisfying, it never will communicate what we're talking about here today. And we're back to Peter and John had a different story, as you were talking about earlier with Jesus. I don't know why God gives different experiences to different people. I would like everybody to be able to experience sexuality in a way that's full and complete and really good, I think, as God intended. But that's not going to happen for a lot of people.
And for those people, I do think it's important to... we're back to a similar tension to where we started this program. On the one hand, it's important that we underline the beauty of what God has done with sexuality. On the other hand, its beauty is not transcendent, and it's not salvific. You know, we are not saved by sexuality. This may sound really odd, but we live in a culture that teaches that. The movies, the lyrics of the songs we listen to, all of them are suggesting that the very reason for my existence is to find either that person or that sexual experience or that romantic experience that's going to bring me, it's going to transcend the mundane and bring me meaning to my existence. It can't bear the weight of that. As beautiful as it is, like a flower, it's this beautiful thing that can be spoiled, that can be destroyed, that can be certainly abused and made into a horrible thing. But it's this thing that God intended to be this beautiful thing in my experience, but he did not intend it to be the sum and substance of my life. It's of such little importance in the long run that there will be no, at least there will be no marriage and giving in marriage in heaven, Jesus said. And I take that to mean there will be no sexuality as we know it in the kingdom of God. It's something for here and now. It's something
man.
That's beautiful here
Seems
and now.
Seems like it should be in heaven, too. It's got to be there some way.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's really true. It's hard to imagine. What would it mean to be a human being and not be a sexual being?
It's hard to imagine.
That.
Yeah.
But that's how temporary it is. That's how ultimately unimportant it is. That whatever real fulfillment of my humanity is, it doesn't need to have sexual intimacy and sexual fulfillment as part of it. Eternal life itself is going to be had one day without any sexuality.
So what you're trying to say is that it's great that God gave this to us. But on the other hand, if he didn't give it to us, we haven't lost out on the essence of what life is about.
Right.
We are deprived of something that lots of other people have. That's good. But we're not deprived of the very most important and essential part of life.
And we could say that about a lot of things. You know, the blind person is deprived of sight. The deaf person is deprived of hearing. Somebody whose sexuality has been a victim of abuse and so on may have had sexuality ripped out of their hands as some rewarding experience. I'd say the same thing about all three of them, is that they have not lost out on life itself. God has not deprived them of eternal life. The reason it's so important to say that with respect to sexuality is because there are so many voices in our culture telling us that if we're missing out sexually, then we just might as well not live. I mean, we've just really lost out on everything. And it's not just people who... It can be a husband or wife living a mundane, ordinary existence and just not altogether all that excited about their sex life and their marriage. That person hears that message, and they get this longing for what could have been and what they think should have been. I really should have had this transcendent romantic sexual experience, and that doesn't seem to be happening. In order to give meaning to my life, I need to go find it. And I think there are real people out there in the real world who are driven by that quest. And they go out seeking to have an affair or go into some fantasy world in their head because they think that's what life is all about and that they've really missed out. And I think my message to them is, you haven't missed out. I mean, itself can be very ordinary and mundane. It's never a transcendent experience. It can be a beautiful experience, but it's never a transcendent experience.
But Jack, in the sense, and I really agree with you, but I want to, in these last few minutes, bring up this other issue. I'm talking about sex as being a really beautiful thing, something that I obviously think is wonderful. However, that's not something that I thought 20 years ago. It has been through the process of getting to know my husband, getting to know myself, getting to being in a relationship that's one of just down-to-earth commitment that is really tough work. And we've talked about the tough work of marriage, and I know that's just a cliche to say tough work of marriage or the hard work of marriage, but I think we've spelled it out more in the past. And that my sexuality just didn't come because I had a sense of my own freedom sexually once I got married, or even, I mean, at all. It's been a real pilgrimage. It's been a real long journey for me to say now, in the recent years, I really do like and appreciate my sexuality. And I would say to a husband and wife who are not experiencing this, I would want them to look more closely at the depth of their relationship, at the commitment of their relationship, at the work they've done in their relationship. Because many times it's out of that work that we have a sexual relationship that's very fulfilling. It cannot be apart from that. Right. It is in and through the development of a relationship that has been sought with blood, sweat, and tears to get to this point that I am arriving at, or I am coming to, or I am experiencing more and more in my life. It's come from that. So I understand what you mean, that it's not the end all of life. However, it could be a symptom that the relationship needs work. Because our sexuality, and it could be that I need some help to understand about sexuality. It could be very specific just to that. But usually it's not. Usually there's something that has to do with sexuality. With development marriage. Of a relationship.
Yeah, with marriage as well.
And I see that in working with people who are married, that they'll first start, you know, and needing to work just on their marriage, just to get to know each other, to open up to each other, to have some kind of emotional vulnerability with each other, to be able to talk, to be able to understand each other, and to learn to stand on their own two feet and become a person in their own right and bring their own sense of who they are, their values, their beliefs into a relationship and have something strong. After developing that with people, very often people will say, okay, our sex life isn't very good. We'd like to bring that alongside. They all of a sudden, it clicks that, oh, that could be a good thing. That could be a valuable thing. They might have been very licentious in their sex in other ways. So they might be highly sexualized, but they don't have a deep and enduring sexual relationship in the context of their marriage that is good and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it's out of that development of relationship that they come to awaken to, oh, there's something good here. There's something new here. There's something I want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Maybe the way to put it is that sexuality begins as a powerful force in our life. It can become a beautiful force in our life, a beautiful reality. It can also become very horrible. It's inherently powerful, but it's only in the context of a committed marriage relationship that it can grow and develop into a really beautiful thing.
And that's another, you know, vote for committed relationship.
Yeah.
Is I just cannot see sexuality being what it really can be outside the context of a committed relationship. It just blossoms. It's like digging roots deep into soil. I have some big, beautiful camellias out in my yard, and they are 60 years old. They have got roots deep down, and you see these trees that are just today full of flowers. They're big and beautiful. And that's like our sexuality. The deeper it grows in the context of a relationship, the more available we are to a sexuality in a context of relationship that's really good, really valuable.
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801.
You know, Jack, today we were going to talk about sensuality.
Now,
I don't know if we've ever said that. But we didn't get to that place. Instead, I think we talked about some issues that are really important to both of us and have bearing on our sexuality. I think there were things we really wanted to say, things that really grab our hearts and kind of help us understand life from a bigger perspective. One of the things that was really important to me today that we talked about was something that we said last week, and I think you brought it up again today, was it's only in the context of understanding God's grace, God's mercy, God's forgiveness, that we really can admit to the depth of our sinfulness. And apart from that, we really need, we feel the need to protect ourselves from seeing the reality of who we are. And especially in this area of sexuality, when we fail so much, we need to be really willing to look ourselves in the face, look ourselves in the eye and say, this is really where I'm failing, and not make excuses for it.
And we also talked about the nature of our evil, what exactly it means to be an evil person. And we were talking generally, not just in the area of our sexuality, but certainly it is relevant, very relevant to our sexuality, that the evil that is in me, it goes very deep and affects every aspect of who I am. So we need to alter our expectations accordingly. We need to recognize that even when I don't intend to do evil, evil is very likely to be present. And it's affecting my relationships with people. It's affecting my choices. It's affecting my way of looking at the world. It's just there as an ever-present reality. We didn't talk about this in the program, but that doesn't change when I become a Christian. As a disciple of Jesus, it doesn't suddenly disappear and go away. It's a reality that I'm going to live with until I leave this age and enter into the perfect age that's to come. So it's this ever-present reality I have to come to terms with. And that affects the way we look at our standards. We must not, we dare not lower the standards of what God's expectations are based on how unreachable they are, because I'm not the kind of person who can kind of naturally live up to that kind of purity and that kind of goodness and that kind of righteousness. We need to keep the standards high so that we can know ourselves more accurately. The higher my standard is, the more I see how profoundly evil and how profoundly needy I am and how much I need God's mercy. And that's a good place to be, not a bad place to be.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.